Today's date is August 21st, 1997. The speaker is Dwayne Edison. The topic is Prophet of Peace, Shalom, Isaiah of Jerusalem.
Thank you, Lord, for the gift of your prophet Isaiah and the message that he gives to us today. Open our hearts and our ears and our minds that we may listen and begin to understand, that we too may share in his vision of shalom. In Jesus' name. Amen. I'm Dwayne Edison. I am a semi-retired college teacher of Bible, ethics, Native American studies, and world religions, and just about everything else in that area. On that, I've taught for 26 years at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, and now I'm doing part-time teaching among adults at enrichment education, and also teach occasionally fairly regularly at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And my wife Eva and I live in Fridley in suburban Minneapolis. Today we're going to take a look at Isaiah of Jerusalem. And this is the format that we'll have. I want to say something about the book and the setting. And we'll look and concentrate in several texts. Chapter 6 is the passage about the call. And all of these passages, I think, are familiar to most of us. We then will talk about the person. On that, we'll talk that one of my favorite passages, the Song of the Vineyard in chapter 5. Isaiah says he has a friend. And you can imagine Isaiah as a folk musician out here singing about this guy that grew a vineyard and the people that moved in into it and did not take their very bad tenants. And an image that sort of rings bells with probably some of us on that. Is one of the many images of the relationship of God and the people. To take a look at our key passage, 9, 1 through 7, one of the messianic passages of enrichment. And with each prophet, we'll take a heart, and the heart, I would suggest, of Isaiah is verses 6 and 7. Again, very familiar passages that uncle was set to music, and so we know them from the Messiah, if nowhere else. And then to talk about the message, he has many strings, many themes, there's a richness. They're on the board here, but two of them that I want to lift up, the idea of shalom. And we'll talk more about what that means for Isaiah and perhaps for us. And then only after you've talked about shalom and about the idea of the remnant, can you begin to talk about the idea of Messiah. I put the term Messiah in quotes. The term does not appear in the book of Isaiah, or in Isaiah 1 to 39. It does appear later in the book of Isaiah, referring to the Persian king. It's simply the term meaning the anointed one. But that term has taken the meanings of a variety of meanings here of one who is to come, who will establish God's time of peace. The fundamental images of the time of peace and how that is to be done are given to us by Isaiah. To be an Orthodox Jew fundamentally means that you are waiting for the Messiah to come. To be a Christian fundamentally means that Jesus has fulfilled these prophecies, particularly the prophecy of Isaiah. The one who would bring in the age of the peace has come and is still in our midst. So both the Jewish and the Christian faith have taken a definite shape here because of the prophecies of Isaiah. The setting. We're still in the 8th century. We talked here, those of you here, the last couple sessions, we talked about the prophet Amos, that radical screaming prophet from the southern desert who came to the northern kingdom of Israel. And then the hometown boy, Hosea, here, who poured out his heart about the love of God and the disappointed love of God that spoke from within, this sort of thing. And that's against the background that the great kingdom of Solomon dissolved in the 10th century before the time of Christ. primarily because of a stupid rule of the great King Solomon, who was not so wise, that sort of is suggested sometimes. And the great part of his kingdom broke off and took the name Israel, put his capital at Samaria, its religious shrine at Bethel, and these were in the stories that we've looked at, lost most of the religious sort of fervor and content of the covenant arrangement or the partner relationship with God. And both of the prophets we've looked at thus far were prophets in that setting. And about the same time, or shortly later, our attention, Isaiah appears in Jerusalem. And I'll call him Isaiah of Jerusalem for two reasons. I mean, he speaks of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is the part of his imagination and his image and his message. A long career. We'll begin with the call in chapter 6 in a moment. In the year that King Uzziah died, 742 before the Christian era, a long career of 55 years. And after we read the text, we'll talk some more about the person here, but we'll note that he is a very public figure. And again, those who are new today, to remind us of the events. The great realities politically in those times and for human survival was the rising nation of Assyria to the east in the northern part of the Mesopotamian Valley. Quite a long ways away. And that is always in a series of great and powerful kings, but now on the rise and at its peak is probably, or is without doubt, in that part of the time and history, the most vicious nation and ruthless nations upon the earth. They literally enjoyed tearing up women and babies and foreigners. And most people do it as a matter of course, it's a part of war. And they had the policy set in long before this that they would come in and put in these countries, they would sort of wipe out all the leaders and then take the people and ship most of them out, keep a few there, so that they would intermarry with the new ones that would come in. And so the great nation of Israel, the 10 tribes, those that prided themselves to be the continuation, of the story of Joseph and of Jacob and of Moses, of the patriarchs, were literally blasted from the face of the earth. They are no more. Footnote, in Jesus' time we speak about the Samaritans. These were, quote, the mongrel people that had come in, that had been mixed here a long time before. And for the people around Jerusalem and Judah, these were not really Jews. And so that deep contempt here traces back to this sort of time. And so Isaiah does his ministry, that long career, and a couple of days we put in here. 722, Samaria, or the great bulk of the Jewish people, are simply wiped from the face of the earth, practically speaking. There is no community anymore, no continuity. And then in 701, just by circumstances beyond their willing and doing, Jerusalem and Judah, which is really no more than the space of a few counties there, and the ancient city of David, out of which Isaiah speaks here, was spared at this time. But during that whole time, there were machinations here between the only way to survive here and those is to play the game of power politics. You had the great nation of up and down all the time of Egypt, and they were from the north and the south. I mean, they were very on that. And the nations that would be in the upper part or lower part of the Mesopotamian Valley, a long ways away. But as we noted, here we're on the Grand Central Station, or crossroads, where this story takes place. Jerusalem quite a little bit off the path, and that's probably the reason it survived. But Samaria and Galilee, Megiddo, which becomes Armageddon, is really where most of the armies, many of the battles were fought in this whole area. I mean, because the armies of Egypt here had these proxy wars, and they wanted to control these little states that were there, nations there. If they didn't cooperate, you would slap them down, and typically you came in, if you pay heavy tribute and give your loyalty here to take one side or the other, then you would be part of the game. But the other kingdom came in, and so these were always trying to align themselves with one or the other, or with the other. And a part of the story here, Judah, the southern kingdom, was invited to become a part of this anti-Assyrian alliance. And the king, I think with Isaiah's advice, didn't do it. And the other nations turned on them, okay, we'll fill you. And so they sort of went to war against them. So most of these nations were fighting each other because the great superpowers were there, and they were sort of caught in this whole mess. About half or more of Isaiah's texts deal with the issues of advice on foreign policy. And behind that, there is a theology. But here, we'll deal with the issues of faith because and go to the heart of the matter. A note here, we'll be looking today at chapters 1 through 39, Isaiah of Jerusalem. We have the book of Isaiah, which is a remarkable unity of 66 fat chapters. Chapters 40 to 55 come out of another era, although they share some of the great concerns. But the time is out of captivity in Babylon. And Isaiah is the one that warns, you know, it's not Assyria you have to worry about. It's another power that's going to be even greater, and that's Babylon. And, of course, these stories we'll pick up next week when we come to this. And if there are two great prophets in the Old Testament in terms of greatness in a variety of ways, the greatest of the prophets without parallel is the writer that we look at today. The second greatest is also in that same scroll of the book of Isaiah 40 to 55. And so we'll deal with that next week. And just a note, then we'll look at the text. One more. That we are today in the presence of a genius. There is no mind, humanly speaking, like it, the Old Testament. Lutherans ought to love thing, because here we have a theologian of the first order. That literally one who reflects in depth an application here about the reality of God. And nobody does it there. If you take courses in literature in college, you will read from Isaiah, because he has some of the finest literature in the ancient world. You listen to the images. He is very, very visual. You can see the images. He is musical. I mean, the guy, I'm sure, is a talent in music and art, but fundamentally here, he is one who is in touch, and we'll look at a moment in chapter 6, who has heard in a terrifying way the call of God. Turn to chapter 6, and I would like to somebody read that, and the rest of us listen to it. The first part is the call, and then the announcement of a strange text about the message. But let's begin. Who would like to read? Okay. 6:1 and following. 15.
In the year that King Uzziah died, I heard the Lord sitting on the throne.
Oh, I saw the Lord. I didn't.
Pardon?
Mine says I saw the Lord.
I'm reading New Revised.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. That's interesting.
Saw.
Sorry. No, I just want to do that because that he sees things, but he also hears. Go ahead.
I saw the Lord sitting on. Did I say here?
Yeah.
He heard you say here.
And you've been used to hearing the Amos and the.
We saw you. We saw you. You said, would someone else like to do this?
No, now we know because I just wanted to underline it. That underlined my text.
This is not going to be a good day. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The pivots on the threshold shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin has blotted out." Then I heard a voice heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go and say to this people, keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand. Make the mind of this people dull, and stop their ears, and shut their eyes, so that they may not look with their eyes, and listen with their ears, and comprehend with their minds, and turn and be healed." Then the Lord said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until the cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate, until the Lord sends everyone far away, and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will be burned again, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump."
I've got goosebumps. What do you hear? Many of these words and phrases are familiar. We sang one part of it last night. I grew up singing "Holy, Holy, Holy," which is taken from that, and we probably have dozens of hymns that relate to this text. But what do you hear now when you hear it? Or what do you see? Jeremiah, or Isaiah style.
I see an Isaiah who lifts up God as very holy, holy. I mean, just, he's in awe of God.
Right.
So he lifts him up on high and just glorifies him.
Nowhere in any place do I find any text that lifts up, and you find it the other places in Jeremiah, that God is such an awesome and terrifying power, and he visualizes that awe. So the image we have here is a way of doing it. You have these angelic beings, the seraphs, here that you don't even able to approach, that God is so awesome, so lifted up. And he has been called in his vision to God's presence. That would scare me. That does need a different direction. And most of us don't have the vision of Isaiah. I teach world religions, and this is a text I teach in world religions because this is one of the classic experiences of the divine, the transcendent we believe, coming in human form. And in world religions, Isaiah ranks here among Moses and Muhammad and Confucius and that as a great interpreter of the transcendent power that sort of pervades the universe. And so, he is a world-class figure. Yes, God is awesome and high, lifted up. What else?
He obviously feels very inadequate, unclean, and I don't realize he lives among unclean people.
Yeah.
So we knew that before, and
But it made clear, because the holiness of God makes him very much aware of his unclean lips, unclean people. This is a good Lutheran text for the Lutherans that are among us here. A good Lutheran text, because here we're lifting up that, profound here sense of sin that separates us from God. St. Paul picks up on this, and Martin Luther picks up on this. And so that great theme of, the issue that we deal with is sort of the uncleanness in a moral sense, not in a ritual sense, moral sense. It becomes one of the great themes that are a part of the lives of many of us. Yes, Linda.
It's not that he's accused of being unclean.
No.
It's his own understanding, and then the graciousness is that this is removed for him, and he needs this.
Yeah.
It's never imposed upon him.
That's a good insight, yeah. Yes.
This has to contain one of the great Lutheran questions of all time. Here he is in the presence of God and God is saying, "Who will I send? He's the only one there."
Hey,
I can see Bill Cosby doing a routine on this one. I thought one of those therapy ones. Yeah, I mean, this is what the angels were. I think the question is, well, I don't know, I think it's a real question. You know, we don't have the vision of Isaiah, and then we raise that question, and maybe it's awfully hard to answer it unless you have that sort of a presence in me. Well, I said, yeah. I thought you were referring to the text that follows as some of the most difficult passages in the Bible, because, you know, then he's given the message here to speak, and as he delivers the message, they become, you know, like we had this morning, more like the mule and the donkey. They become more resistant, and so you preach in order they become more rebellious. And the strange paradox or mystery of what goes on here is, you know, we could take a whole class in sort of doing that, because St. Paul picks this up as well. But back to the vision itself. You know.
I see a paradox that I have never been able to understand, because he is saying, say to the people, don't try to understand, don't try to see, don't try to hear, just turn and be. And it's a simple turning to God, apparently, that without trying to understand, makes it, brings healing.
I keep coming back to Heschel because there are sorts of things. He has a chapter in Chastisement, but also a chapter in Isaiah that he wrestles with. And what sense do we make of this? Because this is a strange way of speaking about these things. And Heschel says that, that punishment has not done it. I mean, you've clobbered them, and still that mule is, that donkey is rebellious. And you've sweet-talked it and do it, and still it doesn't do it. And all of a sudden, this thing here just sort of pour upon it this preaching, and you drive the hardness of heart to its depth. It's almost like a 12-step program. Only, that's one way of looking at it. I'm not sure if this is a, you go to the depths when you realize you have nothing. And that's historically what happens, by the way. And then the renewal begins. Yes?
This sort of seems like some of the words of Jesus, too, when he talked about the people who couldn't understand.
Oh, yes.
He says, it's not given to you to understand now until later, you know. It sounds similar to that.
Jesus and every New Testament writer. I mentioned St. Paul, but, again, this is one of these books of the Old Testament that is sort of well known and constantly referred to as Isaiah. And so that is well known. And without doubt, in the Jewish community and in Jesus' time, this is the overwhelmingly great book of God's prophecy. And so do not be surprised along the way to find words of Jesus, and most of their allusions. I mean, you know that this is in the background, that even when they're not quoting. And so I think that's one way of reading Isaiah, and you do that with this in Jeremiah too, that all of a sudden you will find how deep and subtle those connections are. Yes.
The other day in Hosea, we were talking about God getting rid of all the people, go away from me, you've been bad, you haven't done anything good. And so we asked, well, if God leaves us, who do we go to? Now here he's talking to Isaiah and say, well, like he said, there's nobody else there. So he's going from go away from me now, hi there, how are you?
Well, then in the next passage we'll look at, it's a profound way that this is this sort of awesome sort of thing that sort of grabs him in the vision in the temple there, that there's something that he might have been a priest because of that. We'll sing this sort of folk song about my friend. God is his friend. And so they have that string in that too. And so, like listening to Mahler, and all of a sudden you hear this sort of, sort of Austrian sort of folk music in the countryside, and then sort of, you know, after you hear the two blasts of the horns that blast you out of the hall. And so he plays a variety of strings there, and are, instruments in that. But,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting how quickly Isaiah answered God's question.
Okay.
I mean, it's like, I don't have to go home and pray about it. I'll go, send me.
Yeah.
I mean, even though he was overcome, it seems, by the power and the majesty of God, he immediately says yes.
Yeah. Almost without exception, the great exception is Jonah. The prophets are obedient, and that amazes me of that. And they didn't want the job. But Isaiah is probably the most willing of the prophets. And he sort of, God overwhelms him. on that. It's true of, we talked about Amos too. Amos described that in language. You know, you sort of meet a lion in the path in the wilderness, and you pay attention. And God has come to him like the lion. In fact, the image of the lion is used in Isaiah too. But here the great passage is this awesomeness of God. It's a vision. You know, how do you account for that? I want to come back to this, but and I invite you to hear. God is on the throne. He's lifted high. It speaks about the glory of Yahweh, the glory of the Lord that will be filling the earth. And so it's not simply up there, but it is sort of flowing around you. It flows from here at the throne. Probably the most important word here is holy. I teach world religions, and Heschel argues, and I think he's essentially right. In the ancient world, the category of sacredness or holiness is the fundamental category. That the divine or the other here is powerful and dangerous. And all of a sudden, in a clear way, apparently for the first time, the idea of holiness is connected with conduct, with moral justice and righteousness, the theme of Amos. And the holiness of God has as much to do with quality of life and action as it does with the distance and the power of God. So immediately when he sees that, what does Isaiah sing? He is the man of unclean lips, the people of unclean lips. He is aware in a shattered way. Luther thought, I love this, to pick this up, of the sinfulness, of the inadequacy, of the finiteness, the limitedness of our sort of beings. That theme could be picked up by other prophets, but Isaiah does it most powerfully. And here we have a clue that through much of the foreign policy sort of stuff we have in the story of that God is the ruler of the nations. Even Assyria and Egypt are doing God's biddings. You and Judah do not recognize this. Is that marvelous passage in chapter 10. It's almost a term, a phrase of contempt. I can't whistle. And so God whistles, and evil Assyria comes to do God's bidding. And she will chastise Judah. But Assyria does, of course, with ruthlessness, and they will have to be accountable for that. And so the accountability and responsibility are not taken away. You have this great and powerful God who is in control of the fate of the nations, but at the same time, in good Jewish tradition, that human responsibility is never removed, it is never lessened. And that's part of the idea of the sense of responsibility of, we could even say, guilt, because he must be forgiven there. God is indeed powerful. I know of no prophet that speaks more eloquently about the power and the awesomeness of God and the greatness of God. I said, here you have the first-class theologian of the Old Testament, who not only has these images and ideas, but he relates them to all that is around him. And that long career, and we don't know where some of these passages have come from, he has a chance to connect those to experience and things along the way. A couple of other things before we go to that other text, and if you still want to say some things about that chapter 6, keep that in mind. We said the long career, he is a public figure. Much of his prophecy deals with public policy. You know, the most stupid thing you could do is to make alliances with kings like Egypt. In fact, chapter 20 here, typical among the prophets, he says that Isaiah walks along the street practically naked, not stark or buck naked, as we would say, but he wore the garment of a slave, tattered loincloth. That this is what happens to you if you make these alliances with Egypt over against Assyria. And so the nation of the variety of kings that were there, he served a number of kings under them and gave them advice. They were always playing, they wanted to survive, naturally. This is power politics. Make an alliance with Egypt over Assyria, or align them to be, pay tribute to Assyria and be protected from Egypt. And amidst that sort of situation, the other nations like Israel, the northern kingdom, the Jewish kingdom, there formed an alliance, and they went to war against Judah to get her in line in order to play ball with her. And so, you're constantly in violence. And we'll pick the situation up in terms of the story. 722, and that must have really shocked the people of Jerusalem. The story must have gone by messenger very quickly. No internet then, that Samaria has fallen and razed to the ground, and they're coming this way. And what does Isaiah do? Have no fear. God will protect Zion and David's city. You will be saved, he prophesies, by hand not of man. And all the fortified villages and cities around Judah and the countryside, the fortifications they've had for this to come, were razed to the ground, burned over. You had these references many times for the burned over stumps and the rubble that is around there. All that was left of the fortified city of Jerusalem, and Hezekiah put in the new water supply that still exists in Jerusalem on there. And you have this conversation going over the walls, and so it'd be only a matter of time that the siege would come and Jerusalem would go and the leaders would be dragged off and quartered and so forth, and the people shipped out around the world. But lo and behold, in the midst of this seemingly a clear answer to the prophecy, drew back. A plague had hit the army. And before they had the time to do that, the provinces of troubles were raging in the east, a long ways back in Assyria. So the army pulled back, and you have a time of relative security. No alliances, no warriors, no instruments of war or horses here had saved them. But Isaiah said and prophesied beforehand that the word, the action of God, would save them. Now that is going to be remembered. And so if you're around next week and then Jeremiah, you'll see the flip side of that. Because then we'll see people that the prophets are going around and said, nothing can go wrong, because God will always protect Jerusalem, and Jerusalem will never go. And I don't think Isaiah ever thought Jerusalem could be destroyed. But others took that and removed the moral content and some other sense from it and took it in another direction. And so prophecy is never final. A public figure, I always sort of suggest, and maybe I mentioned that, how would you compare or understand what Isaiah was like? I mean, he's a theologian, he's a poet, he's a musician, but he is like Henry Kissinger. I mean, he has the ears of the rulers. He advises on foreign policy. He has an audience with a whole series of kings. 9 times out of 10, they don't take his advice, and they lose. And so, and the one time, big time, they take their advice just before 701, that they win. And so he becomes a prophet whose words prove true. But I mean, unlike Henry Kissinger, on that, probably 180 degrees different. So, you know, Henry Kissinger was born of Jewish parents, confirmed as a Lutheran, and thought he was God. Like Karl Marx before him, only Karl Marx thought that history was God on that and sort of thing. But a person who had access to the president, and Isaiah has a lot more humility than Henry Kissinger, so be careful if you make that analogy that was there. So he's the insider, but essentially he is ignored. And one of the rare prophets that gets an audience with the king. I mean, but at least he gets heard and not listened to. And he is a nationalist, a patriot. Jerusalem is beautiful and great, and he sings these great phrases about Jerusalem that are there. Or David, 250 years ago, we had this sort of marvelous king, and it's almost sort of a, there was the golden age that was there. David, that man of God, the man of repentance, but also the great and the just ruler. And compared to the others, there really was nobody quite like David in the history of Judaism, even though he had this sort of deal with Bathsheba, and it warts and all, according to the former prophets of the Old Testament and that. But and so he is a nationalist, and he sees that God's promise is connected with David's family, that dynasty, and with the city of Jerusalem. That's the part of his whole understanding that is there. And like most of the prophets, he loves the people, even though they're like that stubborn mule that we talked about this morning. And like all the prophets, he is a man of guts. He is not like Amos that got booted out as the hick from another country, but he is the guy that acts as here, and he speaks fearlessly. He is ignored, he is chastised, he is ridiculed, but he is never really, I know, threatened with death like most of the other prophets are. Again, the doer. The guy that not only speaks his prophecy, as we'll see with other prophets, but he goes out and acts it out. But as Heschel reminds us, of all the great prophets beginning with Amos, the only weapons they ever use are the word of the mouth, and often in Isaiah it'll be sort of visual images, and then they're acted out prophecy. Then his great acted out prophecy is to walk around naked in Jerusalem. This will happen if you make that alliance with Egypt. And his prophecy was proved true. And, you know, they heard the message. They didn't answer it, but a little bit later they said, oh boy, that dumb guy was in Target again. And so he got there. And we've already poked here that, just to underline again the person, here we have a genius of the first order. I mean, a world-class thinker, a world-class imagination, a preacher. If I could preach with the elegance of Isaiah, I mean, you've got it. But you do. Listen to Martin Luther King's recorded sermon sometimes. And Martin Luther King preaches with the language of Isaiah. He's not quoting. I mean, that so informed his mind and thought. You know, the three great influences, a footnote on Martin Luther King, were Isaiah, Jesus, and Mohandas Gandhi. Sort of strange and mixed, sort of there, but Isaiah is one of the great forces, and you'll hear the language of Isaiah ringing forth. And not only Martin Luther King, that's a whole part of the African American experience in America. And Lutherans, I said, will love the theologian, and the archetypes will love the music and the poetry, and they're all first class. But let's turn now to Isaiah as folk singer. Turn to chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. And I again invite the reader a different style. But I think this is one of the most delightful things in Isaiah. Who's willing?
Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a vine vat in it, a wine vat in it. He experienced it to yield grapes.
Expected it
to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed, and it shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyards of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are his pleasant planting. He expected justice, but saw bloodshed, righteousness, but heard a cry. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you are left to live alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely my houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield a mere ephah.
Yeah, why don't we stop with that? And because the highlight of that, and again, I'm going to suggest to use listeners' imagination if you were one there, hearing sort of a equivalent of a modern folk singer to sing that. That again is with the phrase, "He looked for justice and behold, bloodshed." In the Hebrew, this is a pun. The words are almost identical. And this is a very common phrase in many prophets, but in Isaiah, God spoke to righteousness, but he heard a cry. And again, the great themes of Amos that we talked about are deeply a part of Amos, but they're really applied more richly.
What do you hear in this? A kind of lament, folks.
I like that Tron Modern translation. Mine says, friend, my beloved had injured. Like Isaac Edison. I had a farm in Africa. I mean, she begins her phrase or out of Africa. That you know, all of a sudden you hear Isaiah speaking out. My very precious friend had this vineyard.
Let me tell you what happened to it. Simple story. Almost, I can imagine being done in country western. What happened? What does the image say to you?
Didn't bear fruit.
Didn't bear fruit. Expectations were very disappointing.
I was just thinking he was totally disappointed.
Oh, yes. He disappointed.
Because all the indications were that it would be a very fertile place. And he did everything for it.
All the preparations, the shield here from the animals. Keep the deer out and everything else, and you pruned it with the care. And all of a sudden, when harvest comes, you get wild grapes. My advice is not to go to agricultural college and learn how to get good grape stock or something like that. But that's going beyond the image here. But the friend had given such care and love and had such high expectations. If you don't get the point, my friends, this is about you. This is about you. God wanted, at the end of that, righteousness.
Verse 6, is that Henry Kissinger saying, I will command the clouds that they rain no rain upon?
No, that's Pat Robertson. Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger has power over Peking but Pat Robertson is the one who chose the clouds. But here, with Isaiah, it's God that has command. And by the way, that's a whole other dimension, the power over nature. And the references to nature in the book of Isaiah. I mean, we could do a whole week on that. And those sitting out in hold, and the power not only against kings, but it is also, this whole creative order is a part of God's domain as well. So God uses that. Yes?
Well, isn't this sort of turn to the Yahweh of Amos? In addition to not allowing any rain, I mean, there's going to be nothing left of this place.
Yeah.
There's not much compassion here for those who fell short of the expectations.
Then he reluctantly draws back the hedge, will no longer take care of it. I'm going to leave you to the elements. I'm not going to destroy you, but I have protected you thus far. I've cultivated and I've cared for you. And speaking about God in very human terms, but it's like that gardener who says, you can understand what God is like. It's like Hosea too, you're so back, and I'll pull it back, and that place is going to be ravaged. Not a prediction. I mean, the people that take the Bible as a book of prediction don't know what to do with this. I mean, this is sort of a folk song, but that really is profound prophecy that when you have failed and God is seen by the prophets as beginning care and protection and guidance, God will step back. But that's not the end of it. I was going to have us read chapters 1 to 25, because most of the prophets, 1 through 2-5, because it's kind of a summary of the whole message of prophets. There isn't the hint here, there's a hint after chapter 6 reading that we have here, is that always here, let me put it this way. The judgment will come, God will permit it. He will have an instrument, even that Assyria will be the rod of God's anger. And that will do God's bidding. But punishment is not simply punishment. I mean, not to slap down or that. Punishment is discipline. It's purification. Isaiah picks up a very, very ancient Hebrew idea, the idea of the remnant.
and it becomes central to the way he tries to understand what is going on. Punishment is certain to come, but it is not destruction. For God will always leave a remnant. God is in the business of disciplining and purifying. I mean, there are half a dozen or more images of this sort of thing. And God is like lye. He's like the smelter's fire that gets the pure precious metal out of that. God is like the purifier, you know, that takes the cloth and takes out the dirt and the fuller or a bleach that would be sort of there. The images that he have, at the time he speaks, it is obviously that the area surrounding Jerusalem has been burned to the ground, the scorched earth policy. And there you have all these burned over tree stumps. And Isaiah says, out of those stumps will come a shoot of life. On the edge of the desert, and out of that desert, a shoot will go out of dry land. And that's only one of the hands of images that he has of remnant, that he is confident that beyond the hurt and the pain and punishment, new beginnings will come. Somebody asked, it's a real question for us, on that, did God give up on that present generation? And that seems to be the case, because out of that, out of this generation, new beginnings will certainly come. And so you take this idea of remnant becomes a key part of his thinking about how God relates to his people. And it seems for Isaiah, he does not believe, I don't think he can conceive, that God would give up on David, David's dynasty, that God could even give up on Jerusalem, because God loves Jerusalem so much. We have the phrase, Isaiah is the original Zionist. What is Zion? Zion is a hill in Jerusalem. My wife and I were over there a couple years ago, and Zion stands outside the city wall of the old city by some mistake. And this is where David is buried. It's just sort of the peak, and it's sort of just a little ways away from where the temple was built, so they're not identical. I used to think they were. And he takes that sort of hill, Zion, and that becomes the symbol, perhaps the symbol of God's promise. And Zion becomes a poetic image. God loves Zion. He and other prophets that will follow now pick up Dan Erlander's sort of book. They have the hope here that this will be the center of truth and learning and justice and righteousness for all peoples of the earth. And that term, phrase Zion, is probably different from some of the Zionists there. We are Israel, we are surprised how secular Zionism was. I mean, I always thought it was a great religious idea, and it has its roots, but it's become more secular. But here we have the original religious Zionism, that God's intents and purposes of the planet Earth are connected really and also symbolically with this particular place. Isaiah is so much connected with place, Jerusalem, and so much connected with the family of David. Maybe he's wrong, but our whole image of our hymns and our structure of our Christian faith are shaped by that image, as is the Jewish community as well. Before we lived in on the message more details, we touched some of those, let's turn to one of the great messianic passages, chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. And verses 6 and 7, although I could choose easily a half dozen others, use as sort of the heart of the message of Isaiah, and listen especially to the climax of this passage. Who would like to read? Yes.
9, 1 through 7.
1 through 7, right.
I'm reading from New Revised Standard. But there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, you brought into contempt the land of Nebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
The zeal of the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies, will do this.
That's a favorite phrase of Isaiah, but on the verses 6 and 7, we ought to break into the song. Because we are familiar with that in terms of music, and that is appropriate. And the part that precedes it, I think, is necessary to understand it. But again, what do you hear here on the great messianic passages? And there are several great ones of them. He said. Yes.
The beautiful description that we just read before this, that my mind just kept going to Jesus in a simpler way, pruning the fig tree and saying in a more simple way, I am the way, follow me, what you're doing is wrong, do mm-hmm. this and you will be successful.
Yeah.
I understand the simpler way.
Isaiah puts it into beautiful, remarkable images. And tomorrow we're going to deal with Micah, and come around then. And if you want an accessible prophet, Micah is the one. And just to sort of preview of that, Jerusalem is a sophisticated PhD guy that's sort of high in government on that and so forth. And tomorrow we will meet here the guy, the advocate of the migrant worker and the little farmer. And he talks about some of the same things, but from perspective of the little guy. And it is a remarkable book. I call it The Prophet of Simplicity. And but that's in the future. And Isaiah has a full orchestra. And Micah has a little combo out there, and standing silently in the neighborhood cabaret. Linda.
Christians. Love this passage. This is beautiful.
Yeah.
What did Jews make of it?
My understanding depends what you use, because Heschel is not the typical Jew, but in Orthodox Judaism, and I'm not sure how they would relate to this passage, but I think they would use it. This too speaks about Messiah or the Messianic age. And that, we've heard about Jesus. Jesus does not fit the bill. Because when Messiah comes, there will be peace upon earth. And when Messiah came, it meant sort of, hell for our people on that. And we did not see peace upon the earth. I mean, that's the standard argument that those reflected about, because most Jewish people have learned to avoid the pain not to talk about Jesus. They know Jesus almost overwhelmingly in terms of contempt and hatred and death. And even the talk about the favorite messianic passages is very difficult to get. It is changing now in our day, in the last couple decades, to talk about these passages, because they feel that Christians have sort of taken their scriptures and use them as a part of an attack against them. That's a whole other course about that. And last night, before I went to bed, I picked up a book from the bookstore that talked about Heschel. Why is Heschel silent about Jesus? And the guy is a Christian scholar about Islam. He said Heschel is totally silent about the great prophet of the world, Muhammad, too. And he wrestles at that problem, and he talked that problem. And a part of it is my personal experience, that Jewish people, even those that are good neighbors and co-workers, do not want to talk about Jesus because Jesus is bad news. And therefore, what we would call the messianic text would usually be, you know, text of pain. And I think there's probably much more to say about specific texts, but it would be a good question to follow. And because this is probably one of the handful of key messianic texts that we use. And they would say, no, you know, that's not the way to read it, or most likely that we don't want to talk about it.
We have expectations of Jesus' second coming, and if Jesus returns and it's different than that, he's not in a cloud or he comes in a rocket or a business suit, we may say, well, this isn't scripture.
Yeah.
This is not the return of Christ.
Yeah.
And in many ways, the Jewish people really were looking at prophecy and saying, we will have peace.
Right.
They didn't see peace.
Oh, yes.
And so they said, how could this be Messiah when we don't, the scripture is not being fulfilled?
Yeah. They say, you know, their prophecies are not fulfilled because peace did not come. The prophecies of Isaiah that promised a time upon earth in which there would be harmony among people has not come with the coming of Jesus. Now, if Christians, if that were even possible, but to imagine if Christians had come possible, and that meant some way, in some small way, maybe even 10% of what was sort of involved there in the times of harmony among peoples, maybe Jewish people said, this is the Messiah. Well, you know, the first followers of Jesus were Jews, and overwhelmingly for the first generation they were Jews. And they were persuaded in that way, but after the Christian community became essentially Gentile, the Christian community became a community of contempt for its own roots. And somehow in our day, one of the great callings of the church here is to respect your mother, or I would prefer the term sister, because we are a part of this intimate family. And we are the primary ones who have sowed contempt among us. And we have to learn why that pain is there, why that pain continues. And if we believe that Jesus is the Messiah, we have gone about it in a terrible, terrible way. And I think the responsibility of that lies not primarily upon the Jews, upon the Christian community. Martin Luther, good old Saint Martin, learned Hebrew with passion and excitement, learned it well. And he believed as a young man that if only the Jewish people would hear the gospel in its purity and its simplicity, they would come to Jesus. I believe that. I'd like to believe it anyway. On that, and so that he thought that we do, and he went back to get some Jewishness to the text and learn from Melanchthon, who already knew Hebrew, and the humanist scholars of the time. But that, what he thought was the simple message of Jesus, of the gospel, without all these things that the church had cluttered onto it, he thought came, and the Jews did not turn. And for good reason, by the way. Luther, in his latter years, probably sort of helped by all his gut problems, broke out in the most vituperative language you can find any place about the Jews. Because they had not heard, well, they had heard the simple gospel of Jesus and had rejected him. And he couldn't comprehend this, and he was very, very angry. And Luther was angry in general in those years. If I'd had a gut ache every day, I'd been angry too. But that deep disappointment that he had, for that whole relationship. And I mean, it struck me last night when I was reading about Kenneth Craig is a Christian who is not ashamed of the gospel, but is one of the great advocates of dialogue between Jews and Christians and Muslims on that, and trying to puzzle himself why people, not only Heschel, but people like Heschel, never in public speak about Jesus. And never in public, he says, speak about Muhammad. I mean, that's another sort of story, but that's not our story. So, you know, your thing about that messianic text, I think it is really a painful one. And so what we take here, I have my friend Murray Haar, some of you know, he's my colleague at Augustana College, who's an Orthodox Jew who's become a Lutheran, and because he responds to the gospel of grace, but he's also remained an Orthodox Jew in his soil and in his thinking and so forth. And, I mean, he's this guy who's about speaking Yiddish and so forth on that. And he says he grew up in the South Bronx, and he said, we had to sing in these schools, we sang the Messiah. And he said, we learned here, most of the students there were Jewish and Orthodox Jewish, we mouthed the words. We just moved our mouths when we came to these great texts of the Messiah, like this one, I'm sure. And we did that, and they would not sing them. But of course, Murray had bear the bound because he was alienated from his family, and he became a Christian and married a Gentile. And he was essentially dead because he had renounced the family faith. And so that whole division here, and I know this because I've spent, as an advocate for social justice and for work for the poor, about half of my colleagues, even in a place like Sioux Falls where Jews are rare, whatever group I was working in, there were always some Jews that were there. We used to meet on Augustana campus, and we had a friend named Hans Nauen who had survived the Holocaust. He lived in Berlin, and his family and lost most of his family over there. And we lived together, and this guy had such a passion for the little people. And then Augustana campus, just outside my window in the Humanities Building, I looked down on this marvelous Michelangelo replica of Moses. And we'd meet there, and we'd walk down the street, and we'd look up, and we'd say, friend, this is the one that brought us together, the story of Moses, that we sort of shared this common faith. But yet, that deep division remained to his work. He was willing to work on anything to help the little guys of Sioux Falls. Up at that point, he was reluctant to speak about his pain of the Holocaust, and only rarely did he ever speak of what was done. That shortly, he did a trip back to Berlin, and he was invited back here about the communities in Berlin to do that. But he showed to me that sort of thing, that many Jewish people are willing to work alongside you, but are not able to speak about Jesus, which is so central to our faith. Time is up and coffee's there. Shalom, that harmony in and with among all things. Isaiah, the great prophet of Shalom, it's set against the tint of the great contempt against violence and the stupidity of violence. Heschel speaks beautifully about this. The sense that the time of Shalom will come, it is certain. And it may come in the next generation, but more and more we see that that time is off in the indefinite future. And that indefinite future is a kind, and I use that term in quotes, a new age, one that we cannot even imagine. And it only come with the character of a prince of peace that we have in this passage here. A leader like David, or a son of David, meaning of David's dynasty. And so we have a whole series of images of Messiah, although the term Messiah is not used. And the Messianic age, the age to be, will be upon earth sometime in the future. And so the whole idea of Messiah is created, humanly speaking, when you bring together the idea of remnant, that God will punish only to purify, among his people at least. And out of that remnant there, that torn bit of cloth, or that shoot growing up, in the dry desert, or a shoot coming out of that burned over stump, again there is new hope and it begins. And the mixing together, the bringing together the idea of that certain time of harmony among all things, including the earth, made possible by that remnant community led by a David-like figure. And Christians have taken that and said, that so obviously and clearly points to Jesus and his ministry and the life of the church. Yes. But let's hear our story alongside the Jewish story, particularly the Orthodox Jewish story. There is the Messiah who is coming. He may come tomorrow. He may come 100 years from now. Jesus did not fit the bill, but he is coming. We're all dedicated, I hope, to the time of Shalom and sharing in the community that brings Shalom. Sometime, perhaps, I hope in my lifetime to see that Jesus could be seen as a Prince of Peace by all people. Thanks a lot. Isaiah is great.